at my back. I'm heading down the river, ain't no turning back. All right, welcome to the Nameless Security Podcast. Thanks for finding your way over here. I'm Dennis Fisher, Executive Editor of Information Security Magazine and SearchSecurity.com. When I started this podcast a couple months ago, I had a list of people I wanted to get on here at some point, and my guest today was right at the top of that list. It's just taken me a little while to get it done. The guest is Billy Hoffman, Manager of the Web Security Research Group at HP. Billy joined HP through the acquisition of Spy Dynamics, where he made his name as one of the top Ajax and JavaScript security researchers out there. He got his start doing a little research on his student access card at Georgia Tech, which got him the researcher's Purple Heart, a nice lawsuit at the time. He made his way through that, and he's now a frequent speaker at conferences on JavaScript and Ajax security issues, and also is the co-author of the book Ajax Security. This is just a warning. If you're on the treadmill or exercise bike listening to this, you might want to hang on or get off because Billy speaks really fast. All right, Billy, I wanted to start out, I don't know if you've heard anything about it, but Google apparently released a browser.
Wait, they did?
Yes.
Yes. You might hear about it.
Read up on that. So I don't know if you've had much time to check it out, but I know that it's got it makes a lot of use of Ajax and JavaScript, and it's able to run full-on applications. What's your thoughts so far on what you've read, what you've seen, what you've heard about it?
Actually, a couple of thoughts. One, I'm glad somebody else is entering the space. Something I've been hearing a lot is, "Oh, why is Google in this? This is silly." You know, we pretty much saw a lot of innovation stagnation after the first browser wars, and really in the last 2 years, you know, with Internet Explorer 7, Internet Explorer 8, you know, Firefox 2, Firefox 3, we're really starting to see great innovative features going in. And so I love that. In fact, when the ACID 3 test came out, it's for browser standards compliance. I had to laugh because, you know, Opera is like, well, we just released a nightly build and it gets, you know, 72%. And then, like, the WebKit guys are like, haha, we're up to 78%. And I'm like, when was the last time browser manufacturers were fighting each other to see who could be more standards compliant? I mean, that's just, you know, what type of bizarro world where everyone has goatees did I just fall into? So I love the fact that Google's going to play in this space. And really what I love is the platform they're building to run applications on. You know, they've redesigned, JavaScript, their interpreter, from the ground up. They're kind of with V8. And the performance numbers I've seen on it are incredible. Where I think it's falling short is that they're thinking still about, when they talk about security, they're still talking about kind of security and as it relates to the host operating system.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to run as a low privilege. You know, we're going to have a blacklist of sites that we know that has malware or phishing sites and alert you. And it's kind of like, okay, that's nice. You know, 2004 called and kind of wants its security features back. But, you know, it's a good step. What I think they're really failing to address are web application security vulnerabilities. So where's my built-in cross-site scripting filter? Where's my built-in password vault? Or maybe something that actually will generate a one-time password. So I don't even know what my actual password for, like, Citibank would be. You know, and I'm using a different password for every single site because of this feature.
I would love that.
You know, What about something that does blacklisting of sending requests to certain URLs? So not just simply don't visit this website, but, you know, something maybe more akin to, like, Adblock or some of these privacy things with IE8 about, you know, don't even talk to these things. Don't send those web beacons.
Right.
You know, they have the, you know, the nice little, I think they're calling it incognito mode.
Yes.
Everyone is calling it porn mode, which, you know, really...
it does have a little picture of a guy in a trench coat at the top.
It does. So. I mean, they're kind of not really, you know, trying to dispel what that thing is probably used for by 99% of the browsing population, which is nice. I mean, they're starting to think that's a little bit more web application security focused because they're thinking about what is this web application doing that either endangers, you know, its users' privacy or their personal information. But I want to see them do more, and they're not there yet.
Okay. So it, overall, nice first try. Let's see what else you got.
Certainly. Yeah, no, in terms of a platform, I think it's excellent. I think it kicks the crap out of anything else out there because, for example, it has Google Gears integrated into it.
Right, right.
You know, so this whole idea of, you know, it's a web app, but you can use it when you step on a plane, you know, it's they've got that built in, and the fact that they've got a Flash or a really a feature-rich JavaScript interpreter built in, and the fact that they've isolated the tabs. Not so much because they just kind of touted the security of that. That one tab, you know, it can't inspect the others. That it's being isolated. You know, I really view it as I'm opening a PDF in one version, one tab of Firefox 3, and I'm running a YouTube movie in another, and I don't get stuttering, which is what I get now.
Yep.
So from a platform point of view, I think they're really doing it right. From a security point of view, they're doing stuff that the major browsers were doing either natively or through plugins 4 years ago.
Right.
So they need to catch up there and really also try to focus on, hey, what can we do about web application vulnerabilities as opposed to what can we do about protecting people from getting, traditional malware through the web.
Right, yeah. And you mentioned the performance. It is really, really fast. There's no doubt about that. But, if it's not fast and safe, then,
Exactly.
There's other problems. So let's talk a little bit about the Black Hat talk you did this year. We talked about it before over a phone call, but tell everybody a little bit about the talk you gave and sort of the ways that you were able to find to evade analysis with JavaScript.
Sure. So my talk at Black Hat USA 2008 this year, luckily Jeff was very nice. They had me back. I've spoken there last couple years. So it's always a good time. I was focusing on techniques that JavaScript malware can use to circumvent automated analysis. That sounds like a very, esoteric topic that, would be someone's PhD thesis that never gets, read by anyone. Actually, what it is, it's incredibly relevant, really, to both end users and, browser manufacturers, anyone involved in computer security today. IBM ISS released a report about a month or so back that said, people are using the web to distribute malware, traditional malware, keyloggers, that sort of stuff.
Right.
That's exploiting, flaws in the browser, flaws in, Word documents, whatever. They're distributing it through the web. And one of the things attackers are doing now is instead of just throwing down a malformed, document or throwing down malicious ActiveX controls or whatever, they are first encoding them or obfuscating them with JavaScript to basically get it past your perimeter defenses.
Yeah.
So your firewalls or your intrusion detection systems, things like that are doing pattern matching or what have you, they don't understand what it is that's going down. In fact, IBM, the report said, it was approaching nearly 100% of all the malware they were seeing was being obfuscated with JavaScript.
Yeah.
So not only is JavaScript being used to kind of, augment and, hide traditional nastiness, over the last 2-3 years, we've seen JavaScript itself can do very nasty things. It can actually act as a keylogger that would work regardless of your, whether you're a Mac or you're a PC or, a Linux box or even your iPhone. We've seen that it can find out what websites you visited, what words you're searching Google for. It can port scan internal networks. And this isn't, spawning ActiveX controls or pulling out other programs. This is just native JavaScript running in your browser can do very nasty things. So being able to determine what JavaScript is doing is really taking on a key problem in the security space right now. And so what a lot of security vendors, McAfee, FinGen, IBM, they're starting to do is take this JavaScript and run it in a sandbox before they let it go through to the, to the end user, trying to figure out what it does. The problem is that, and so they're using a variety of techniques to try to, figure out what this does, to analyze the JavaScript. Well, the problem is that the sandbox they're running it inside of is different and behaves differently than a normal browser would behave.
Right.
And so my research was about, look, is it possible for this nasty JavaScript, when it's being executed, to kind of examine its environment and say, am I inside a sandbox or am I actually inside a real browser? Because if it's inside a sandbox, the JavaScript can just stop.
Mm-hmm.
That way it appears to be benign to the security people who pass it through to the end user where it ends up exploiting them. If this sounds familiar, Dennis, it's very similar to the whole red pill, blue pill thing we had at Black Hat a few years back, which was, can malware, traditional malware, tell whether it's inside of a virtual environment, like VMware, or whether it's actually running on bare metal?
Right.
And, the answer is yes, there are ways you can tell whether you are in VMware. And it's kind of the same concept, can JavaScript tell whether it's in a sandbox or a real browser? So I talked about numerous different ways that the malware actually can detect this.
Yeah, I remember sitting there during that talk, and there were people in the audience just sort of shaking their heads like, oh, man, this is bad.
Yeah.
And it's so, I mean, with all this nasty stuff that JavaScript can do, why do people still use JavaScript? I mean, you can, it's almost impossible to browse the web without it. I mean, you go into Firefox and turn off JavaScript, you got nothing. I mean, websites essentially don't work.
Very true. Very true. You know, I think it's funny because, well, to step back, I have to think somewhere Tim Berners-Lee, who created HTML, must be really, really angry with a lot of people. He must just want to take the people who work on Dojo or the guy that created, you know, jQuery and just punch him in the face and be like, it's a document layout language. What are you doing? You know, it's for arranging paragraphs and tables. It's not for building drop-down menus and modal dialog boxes. But the hacker in me loves it because it shows it's the perfect example of you take something that was designed to do a certain job, and you start, you know, augmenting it and hacking it and finding out, you know what, actually I can do all sorts of really crazy cool things with something that was just supposed to be about laying out a document. And so just flat HTML and JavaScript have kind of been the lowest common denominator, regardless of the browser you're dealing with. I mean, even the web browser on my Razer, Dennis, actually has a JavaScript interpreter in it.
Nice.
It doesn't understand Flash. It kind of understands Java for the games, but, you know, it's really the lowest common denominator. And I think you said it very well, that you basically cannot browse the web today without JavaScript, because we don't really have the web of old. You don't have kind of a series of static pages connected by hyperlinks anymore. You know, you have Google Documents and Sheets and Gmail,
right,
where if you look at the URL, you're at one URL, and everything beyond that is generated by JavaScript. And it's interesting because it was never really intended to do these things. And so from a security point of view, there are some issues there that even Google is trying to address with Google Chrome. But you really can't, because it's the way the Internet just works these days. And you can't put the genie back in the bottle and say, okay, let's redesign this.
Right.
You know, things like Adobe's Flash or Flex, you know, in a lot of ways they're trying to do that. They're trying to say, look, you know, instead of using HTML and JavaScript, which are, you know, for backwards compatibility and the way they were designed, you know, over 10 years ago, they're basically saying, look, here is a Flash plugin. It's a virtual machine just like Java, and you'll run your code on this. And that's how we'll be able to, you know, have better features, make it more secure, et cetera, than just flat HTML and JavaScript. Which is why I think, you know, Google, their browser makes things kind of interesting, right? I don't know how it's going to upset the balance. You know, people are writing kind of Web 2.0 apps in Flash. Some of them might be using Microsoft Silverlight.
Right.
Some of them are using, you know, kind of Ajax and just JavaScript and HTML. So the fact that you now have a browser that's very standards compliant and is performing and executing JavaScript so quickly, you know, it really remains to be seen whether that's going to give kind of a larger kick to people building more applications in just JavaScript instead of these era technologies.
Yeah, and the thing that strikes me is that, you know, in the last 6 or 8 years, we've seen a big push towards software security with, you know, what Microsoft has done with trustworthy computing and other things.
Yes.
But are all of these web developers getting any of that training in terms of writing secure applications?
I'm glad you asked, because this is the frightening thing, right? I mean, if we're moving towards building the browser as the application, or that the browser is the operating system.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, look at Google Chrome, right? The browser has a task manager.
Right, I know.
That tells you processing and how much processing power they're using, how much memory they're using. It allows you to kill tasks. I mean, it is an operating system for all intents and purposes. And when you look at, you know, your Outlook or your, you know, Outlook itself even has a web access.
Yeah.
So, you know, you look at how you get your email, how you write documents, how you, you know, talk to your friends, how you share information. It's not things you're installing on your desktop anymore. It's websites you're visiting. And this whole idea of I'm going to store things in the cloud, it's not I'm able to protect my data. You're essentially yielding control to these people who are writing these latest and greatest web apps. And it's like, okay, what do these people know about security? You know, and we're kind of finding the same way in the mid-90s, you know, the desktop developers got their butts kicked because people, and good Lord, even to this day are, you know, with buffer overflows and things like that. I'm going to give you a Word doc, you open it, and nasty things happen because it's going to execute code. You know, we're the same way application developers for desktops didn't know security, we're finding out web app developers don't know security very well.
Right. Yeah, that's a scary prospect.
They're not getting the types of training they need. You know, you say cross-site scripting to them, and they think, oh, that's, you know, stealing a cookie or popping up a little message dialogue. And you have to kind of look at them and say, well, why do you think that message dialogue is appearing? And they're like, well, I don't know. And you're like, well, it's because it's code execution.
Right.
It's not that I popped the dialogue. It's I executed arbitrary code on your box. That's bad. That's about as bad as you can get. In fact, cross-site scripting really is the web equivalent of a buffer overflow.
Right.
And, you know, with the fact that I'm now executing code inside the context of Gmail, that means I can send email just like I was you. I can read your email, read your friends list, read deleted mail, you know, do any of these things that I want to do. And we're slow. The difficult part is, Dennis, is that security used to be something the IT guys dealt with. You know, it's, oh, firewalls, oh, you know, antivirus, anti-spam. Oh, you know, that's something my IT guy put a little box on the perimeter of the network to take care of.
Right.
But with application security, you're talking about, you know, these are fundamental problems in the application itself. You know, first of all, a firewall is not going to help you at all with web application security.
No.
A firewall is a gateway saying, yes, you can talk to this port, or no, you can't. If nobody can talk to your web app, you don't have a very good web app. So firewalls right out the gate are incapable of solving web security issues.
Yeah.
And you just kind of go up the stack, and the who is responsible for this ends up being the developer. And we're really kind of at an odd place where it's like, how do we train them? How do we get them up to speed? You know, it took 15 years for the IT guys to get their act together, and there are orders of magnitude more web developers, or developers rather, than IT professionals.
Yeah, and it almost seems like the web developer world right now is where, like you said, the desktop guys were, you know, 10 or 12 years ago, where it was all about, you know, features and function and getting the thing out there as quickly as you can, in some sort of beta form, and then letting people mess around with it, you know, worrying about everything else later.
You know, the frightening thing is we kind of have this, you know, culture of quickness in the web space. You know, we have this idea of rapid application development, and, you know, you see these, you know, books from Sam's Publishing, which is like, learn, you know, Ruby in 24 hours. You can't learn anything in 24 hours. You can learn enough to be dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
You can learn enough to, you know, write really bad financial software, but you can't even architect a secure application and begin to understand the implications of your design in 24 hours. So it's this idea of for the very applications that you would want lots of thought to go into, we're putting no thought into.
Right.
And it's funny that you said that today, the problems we have today are what the desktop people had to deal with, you know, 10, 15 years ago. It's funny because who's writing your web apps these days? It's a lot of people are your traditional desktop guys. They say, oh, I've written Java for 10 years now. Show me the, you know, web equivalent of a grid view. Or Microsoft is doing this really with its ASP.NET. They say, hey, you're a Windows form developer? No problem. We've got a designer for you to build your page. We've got C#, so the same things you're writing your back-end code. You wrote your desktop code in. You can write your web app code in. Even with things like Silverlight, it's starting to blur the line between where is this code running? Is it on the client? Is it the server?
All right. So a couple more before I let you go. Let's go back in time a little bit here. Tell me about the infamous student research project you did at Georgia Tech that got you in a little bit of trouble.
Once upon a time when I was young and silly. I was a student at Georgia Tech, and I learned about our campus buzzcard system, which kind of controlled many parts of campus. And I found some security flaws in it, and kind of learned firsthand the difficulty one can have in trying to do the right thing and let a company know, hey, there are issues, and how do you remediate and solve when you discover vulnerabilities. And, you know, it's a lot. Actually, this is a problem in the web security, web application security space, too. You know, because people like HD Moore or stuff like that, they can reverse engineer or decompile parts of, say, Word and find out, you know, what happens if, you know, find buffer overflows and how it processes, you know, the track changes of a Word doc. Or, you know, you look at the WMF or like the ANI or some of these other file format vulnerabilities.
Yep.
You know, that stuff's processed on the desktop. And so it's very easy for them to reverse engineer this stuff, find the vulnerabilities. For web application security researchers, they have a really hard time, because if I'm trying to find a bank, or I'm my mom, and I'm trying to find an online bank I'd like to use, how do I know, you know, billysbank.com is protected against SQL injection? How do I know they've done their due diligence? How do I know they've been trained? I mean, sure, I could ask them, and their answer, I very much doubt their answer would be SQL injection, you know? I think their answer would be, of course we're secure, we're a bank,
right.
We know what we're doing. But there's no real way to know. And more importantly, if I happen to inadvertently discover one of these things, how do I let them know? How do I remediate? How do I deal with all of this? The problem with web apps is they own all the code, and it's running on their system.
Yep.
And by definition, you cannot find vulnerabilities in it without breaking the law.
Right.
Short of having their permission, you know, with the types of products that, you know, HP Application Security Center sells. So it's, or when the Web Security Research Group, which I run, you know, does our pen test, we obviously have permission. But, you know, outside of those extremely controlled, very rare circumstances, you know, it's not like regular security research. You know, there's a big deal with disclosure.
Right, and that, you know, how do you avoid getting sued and, you know, going to jail or ending up in some other hairy situation?
Yeah, very true.
All right, so I had one other question that our friend Ashley wanted me to ask you. How did the there was some sort of vending machine brought into a class as part of this research project?
No, one of the things that I did. So in the course of my research, I learned a lot about how you should build kind of these magstripe-based transaction systems securely.
Yeah.
And so I had numerous people in the faculty at Georgia Tech who were very supportive of my work. And about two semesters later, I was taking a class on embedded systems. And so my semester-long project was to build a, you know, kind of, you know, student ID-based system for a campus that you could use for door access, that you could use for, you know, buying, you know, stuff from a Coke machine or, you know, your library card, your
right.
meal ticket, everything.
Yep.
And so I actually built a Coke machine out of wood and metal, and I operated the dispensing a Coke mechanism by taking an RC car apart and using the motor on the wheels to pull a flip, you know, to like trip a flap to drop a Coke, and I hooked a magstripe system up to it, and it talked over Ethernet to a centralized controller. And so it took me like 15 minutes. It was on the fourth floor of this building right next to the College of Computing on Georgia Tech campus, and they didn't have an elevator. And so I had to, for my demo, I had like a 40-minute kind of presentation. But the first 10 minutes was me carting gear up from my car that was, you know, like illegally parked in the loading dock to, you know, bring up, you know, the computer that acted as the server, the computer that I was, you know, that the reader was hooked up to, the actual Coke machine, which was about, you know, 3 feet by 5 feet. I think actually, Dennis, if you do a Google image search on me and like Coke machine or magstripe, you'll actually see pictures of this thing.
Oh, I need to see that. That's fantastic. See,
I'll send you some.
That's what the internet is for, right there.
That is what the internet is for. Well, unless you're using Google Chrome's incognito mode, apparently.
Right, right. No one will ever know what the internet is for.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Cool. Well, that is it, Billy. I appreciate your time, man. Thanks
Certainly.
A lot. And thank you all for listening. As always, if you've got any suggestions for guests or topics, please email me at dfisher@techtarget.com. And for archived episodes of the podcast, visit searchsecurity.com/podcast. And for breaking security news, head to searchsecurity.com. My apologies to Dan Kaminsky. We're out of time. Thanks.